Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Chapter 4, Part 3 of The Idiot by Fyodor Dostoevsky, translated by Eva M. Martin. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Alia Maki. The prince observed with great surprise, as he approached his villa accompanied by Rogojin, that a large number of people were assembled on his veranda, which was brilliantly lighted up. The company seemed merry and were noisily laughing and talking, even quarrelling, to judge from the sounds. At all events, they were clearly enjoying themselves, and the prince observed further on closer investigation that all had been drinking champagne. To judge from the lively condition of some of the party, it was to be supposed that a considerable quantity of champagne had been consumed already. All the guests were known to the prince, but the curious part of the matter was that they had all arrived on the same evening, as though with one accord, although he had only himself recollected the fact that it was his birthday a few moments since. "You must have told somebody you were going to trot out the champagne, then that's why they're all come," muttered Rogojin as the two entered the veranda. "We know all about that. You've only to whistle, and they come up in shoals," he continued almost angrily. He was doubtless thinking of his own late experiences with his boon companions. All surrounded the prince with exclamations of welcome, and, on hearing that it was his birthday, with cries of congratulation and delight. Many of them were very noisy. The presence of certain of those in the room surprised the prince vastly, but the guest whose advent filled him with the greatest wonder, almost amounting to alarm, was Evgeny Pavlovitch. The prince could not believe his eyes when he beheld the latter, and could not help thinking that something was wrong. Lebedev ran up promptly to explain the arrival of all these gentlemen. He was himself somewhat intoxicated, but the prince gathered from his long-winded periods that the party had assembled quite naturally and accidentally. First of all, Hippolyte had arrived early in the evening, and feeling decidedly better, had determined to wait the prince on the veranda. There Lebedev had joined him, and his household had followed, that is, his daughters and General Evolgin. Burdovsky had brought Hippolyte and stayed on with him. Gania and Ptitsin had dropped in accidentally later on. Then came Keller, and he and Kolya insisted on having champagne. Evgeny Pavlovitch had only dropped in half an hour or so ago. Lebedev had served the champagne readily. "My own, though, prince, my own, mind," he said, "and there'll be some supper later on. My daughter is getting it ready now. Come and sit down, prince. We are all waiting for you. We want you with us. Fancy what we have been discussing. You know the question, to be or not to be, out of Hamlet, a contemporary theme, quite up to date. Mr. Hippolyte had been eloquent to a degree. He won't go to bed, but he has only drunk a little champagne, and that can't do him any harm. Come along, prince, and settle the question. Everyone is waiting for you, sighing for the light of your luminous intelligence." The prince noticed the sweet, welcoming look on Vera Lebedev's face as she made her way towards him through the crowd. He held out his hand to her. She took it, blushing with delight, and wished him a happy life from that day forward. Then she ran off to the kitchen, where her presence was necessary to help in the preparation for supper. Before the prince's arrival, she had spent some time on the terrace, listening eagerly to the conversation, though the visitors, mostly under the influence of wine, were discussing abstract subjects far beyond her comprehension. In the next room, her younger sister lay on a wooden chest, sound asleep, with her mouth wide open. But the boy, Lebedev's son, had taken up his position close beside Kolya and Hippolyte, his face lit up with interest in the conversation of his father and the rest, to which he would willingly have listened for 10 hours at a stretch. "I have waited for you on purpose, and I am very glad to see you arrive so happy," said Hippolyte, when the prince came forward to press his hand, immediately after greeting Vera. "And how do you know that I am so happy?"
"I can see it by your face. Say how do you do to the others, and come and sit down here quick. I have been waiting for you," he added, accentuating the fact that he had waited. On the prince's asking, "Will it not be injurious to you to sit out so late?" he replied that he could not believe that he had thought himself dying 3 days or so ago, for he never had felt better than this evening. Burdovsky next jumped up and explained that he had come in by accident, having escorted Hippolyte from town. He murmured that he was glad he had written nonsense in his letter, and then pressed the prince's hand warmly and sat down again. The prince approached Evgeny Pavlovitch last of all. The latter immediately took his arm. "I have a couple of words to say to you," he began, "and those on a very important matter. Let's go aside for a minute or two."
"Just a couple of words," whispered another voice in the prince's other ear, and another hand took his other arm. Mushkin turned, and to his great surprise observed a red, flushed face and a droll-looking figure, which he recognized at once as that of Ferdishenko. Goodness knows where he had turned up from. "Do you remember Ferdishenko?" he asked.
"Where have you dropped from?" cried the prince.
"He is sorry for his sins now, prince," cried Keller. "He did not want to let you know he was here. He was hidden over there in the corner. But he repents now. He feels his guilt."
"Why? What has he done?"
"I met him outside and brought him in. He's a gentleman who doesn't often allow his friends to see him of late, but he's sorry now."
"Delighted, I'm sure. I'll come back directly, gentlemen. Sit down there with the others, please.
Excuse me one moment," said the host, getting away with difficulty in order to follow Evgeny.
"You are very gay here," began the latter, "and I have had quite a pleasant half hour while I waited for you. Now then, my dear Lef Nikolaevich, this is what's the matter. I've arranged it all with Molovstov, and I have just come in to relieve your mind on that score. You need be under no apprehensions. He was very sensible, as he should be, of course, for I think he was entirely to blame himself."
"What Molovstov?"
"The young fellow whose arms you held, don't you know? He was so wild with you that he was going to send a friend to you tomorrow morning."
"What nonsense!"
"Of course it is nonsense, and in nonsense it would have ended, doubtless. But you know these fellows, they—"
"Excuse me, but I think you must have something else that you wish to speak about, Evgeny Pavlovitch."
"Oh, of course I have," said the other, laughing.
"Tomorrow, very early in the morning, I must be off to town about this unfortunate business. My uncle, you know. Just imagine, my dear sir, it's all true, word for word, and of course everybody knew it excepting myself. And all this has been such a blow to me that I have not managed to call in at the Epanchins. Tomorrow I shall not see them either, because I shall be in town. I may not be here for 3 days or more. In a word, my affairs are a little out of gear. But though my town business is of course most pressing, still I determined not to go away until I had seen you, and had a clear understanding with you upon certain points, and that without loss of time. I will wait now, if you will allow me, until the company departs. I may just as well, for I have nowhere else to go to, and I shall certainly not do any sleeping tonight. I'm far too excited. And finally, I must confess that, though I know it is bad form to pursue a man in this way, I have come to beg your friendship, my dear prince. You are an unusual sort of person. You don't lie at every step, as some men do. In fact, you don't lie at all. And there is a matter in which I need a true and sincere friend.
for I really may claim to be among the number of bona fide unfortunates just now." He laughed again. "But the trouble is," said the prince, after a slight pause of reflection, "that goodness only knows when this party will break up. Hadn't we better stroll into the park? I'll excuse myself. There's no danger of their going away." "No, no, I have my reasons for wishing them not to suspect us of being engaged in any specially important conversation. There are gentry present who are a little too much interested in us. You are not aware of that, perhaps, prince. It will be a great deal better if they see that we are friendly just in an ordinary way. They'll all go in a couple of hours, and then I'll ask you to give me 20 minutes, half an hour at most." "By all means, I assure you, I am delighted. You need not have entered into all these explanations. As for your remarks about friendship with me, thanks very much indeed. You must excuse my being a little absent this evening. Do you know, I cannot somehow be attentive to anything just now." I see," said Evgenie, smiling gently. His mirth seemed very near the surface this evening. "What do you see?" said the prince, startled. "I don't want you to suspect that I have simply come here to deceive you and pump information out of you," said Evgenie, still smiling and without making any direct reply to the question. "Oh, but I haven't the slightest doubt that you did come to pump me," said the prince, laughing himself at last. "And I dare say you are quite prepared to deceive me too, so far as that goes. But what of that? I'm not afraid of you. Besides, you'll hardly believe it. I feel as though I really didn't care a scrap one way or the other just now. And as you are a capital fellow, I am convinced of that. I dare say we really shall end by being good friends. I like you very much, Evgenie Pavlovitch. I consider you a very good fellow indeed." "Well, in that case, you are a most delightful man to have to deal with, be the business what it may," concluded Evgenie. "Come along now, I'll drink a glass to your health. I'm charmed to have entered into alliance with you. By the by," he added suddenly, "has this young Hippolyte come down to stay with you?" "Yes." "He's not going to die at once, I should think, is he?" "Why?" "Well, I don't know. I've been half an hour here with him, and Hippolyte had been waiting for the prince all this time, and had never ceased looking at him and Evgenie Pavlovitch as they conversed in the corner. He became very much excited when they approached the table once more. He was disturbed in his mind, it seemed. Perspiration stood in large drops on his forehead. In his gleaming eyes it was easy to read impatience and agitation. His gaze wandered from face to face of those present, and from object to object in the room, apparently without aim. He had taken a part, and an animated one, in the noisy conversation of the company, but his animation was clearly the outcome of fever. His talk was mostly incoherent. He would break off in the middle of a sentence which he had begun with greatest interest, and forget what he had been saying. The prince discovered to his dismay that Hippolyte had been allowed to drink 2 large glasses of champagne, the one now standing by him being the third. All this he found out afterwards. At the moment he did not notice anything very particularly. "Did you know I am specially glad that today is your birthday?" cried Hippolyte. "Why?" "You'll soon see. Do you know, I had a feeling that there would be a lot of people here tonight. It's not the first time that my presentiments have been fulfilled. I wish I had known it was your birthday. I'd have brought you a present. Perhaps I have got a present for you. Who knows? How long is it now before daylight?" "Not a couple of hours," said Ptitsin, looking at his watch. "What's the good of daylight now? One can read all night in the open air without it," said someone. "Well, the good of it? Oh, well, I want to see a ray of sun," said Hippolyte. "Can one drink to the sun's health, do you think, prince?" "I dare say one can. But you had better be calm and lay down, Hippolyte. That's much more important." "You're always preaching about resting. You are a regular nurse to me, prince. As soon as the sun begins to resound in the sky..." "What poet said that? The sun resounded in the sky. It is beautiful, though there's no sense in it." "Then we will go to bed. Lebedev, tell me, is the sun the source of life? What does the source, or the spring of life, really mean in the apocalypse? You have heard of the star that is called Wormwood, prince. I have heard that Lebedev explains it as the railroads that cover Europe like a net." Everybody laughed, and Lebedev got up abruptly. "No, allow me, that is not what we are discussing," he cried, waving his hand to impose silence. "Allow me. "With these gentlemen, all these gentlemen," he added, suddenly addressing the prince, "on certain points, that is." He thumped the table repeatedly, and the laughter increased. Lebedev was in his usual evening condition, and had just ended a long and scientific argument which had left him excited and irritable. On such occasions, he was apt to evince a supreme contempt for his opponents. "It is not right. Half an hour ago, prince, it was agreed among us that no one should interrupt, no one should laugh, that each person was to express his thoughts freely, and then at the end, when everyone had spoken, objections might be made, even by the atheists. We chose the general as president. Now, without some such rule and order, anyone might be shouted down, even the loftiest and most profound thought." "Go on, go on. Nobody is going to interrupt you," cried several voices. "Speak up, but keep to the point. What is this star?" "I have no idea," replied General Ivolgin, who presided with much gravity. "I love these arguments, prince," said Keller, almost more than half intoxicated, moving restlessly in his chair, "scientific and political." Then, returning suddenly towards Evgeny Pavlovitch, who was seated near him, "Do you know, I simply adore reading the accounts of the debates in the English Parliament. Not that the discussions themselves interest me, I'm not a politician, you know, but it delights me to see how they address each other. The noble lord who agrees with me, my honourable opponent who astonished Europe with his proposal, the noble viscount sitting opposite. All these expressions, all this parliamentarism of a free people has an enormous attraction for me. It fascinates me, prince. I've always been an artist in the depths of my soul, I assure you, Evgeny Pavlovitch." "Do you mean to say," cried Gania from the other corner, "do you mean to say that railways are accursed inventions, that they are a source of ruin to humanity, a poison poured upon the earth to corrupt the springs of life?" Gavrila Ardalionovitch was high in spirits that evening, and it seemed to the prince that his gaiety was mingled with triumph. Of course he was only joking with Lebedev, meaning to egg him on, but he grew excited himself at the same time. "Not the railways, oh dear no," replied Lebedev, with a mixture of violent anger and extreme enjoyment. "Considered alone, the railways will not pollute the springs of life, but as whole they are accursed. The whole tendency of our latest centuries, in its scientific and materialistic aspect, is most probably accursed."
"Is it certainly accursed, or do you only mean it might be? That is an important point,"
said Evgeny Pavlovitch. "It is accursed, certainly accursed," replied the clerk vehemently. "Don't go so fast, Lebedev. You are much milder in the morning," said Ptitsin, smiling.
"But, on the other hand, more frank in the evening." "In the evening, sincere and frank," repeated Lebedev earnestly. "More candid, more exact, more honest, more honorable, and, although I may show you my weak side, I challenge you all, you atheists, for instance. How are you going to save the world? How find a straight road of progress, you men of science, of industry, of cooperation, of trades unions, and all the rest? How are you going to save it, I say? By what? By credit? What is credit? To what will credit lead you?"
"You are too inquisitive," remarked Evgeny Pavlovitch. "Well, anyone who does not interest himself in questions such as this is, in my opinion, a mere fashionable dummy. But it will lead at least to solidarity and balance of interests," said Ptitsin. "You will reach that with nothing to help you but credit, without recourse to any moral principle, having for your foundation only individual selfishness and the satisfaction of material desires. Universal peace and the happiness of mankind as whole being the result. Is it really so that I may understand you, sir? But the universal necessity of living, of drinking, of eating, in short, the whole scientific conviction that this necessity can only be satisfied by universal cooperation and the solidarity of interests, is, it seems to me, a strong enough idea to serve as a basis, so to speak, and a spring of life for humanity in future centuries," said Gavrila Ardalionovitch, now thoroughly roused. "The necessity of eating and drinking, that is to say, solely the instinct of self-preservation, is not that enough? The instinct of self-preservation is the normal law of humanity." "Who told you that?" broke in Evgeny Pavlovitch.
"It is a law, doubtless, but a law neither more nor less normal than that of destruction, even self-destruction.
Is it possible that the whole normal law of humanity is contained in the sentiment of self-preservation?"
"Ah!"
cried Hippolyte, turning towards Evgeny Pavlovitch and looking at him with a queer sort of curiosity.
Then, seeing that Radomski was laughing, he began to laugh himself, nudged Kolia, who was sitting beside him with his elbow, and again asked what time it was. He even pulled Kolia's silver watch out of his hand and looked at it eagerly. Then, as if he had forgotten everything, he stretched himself out on the sofa, put his hand behind his head, and looked up at the sky. After a minute or two, he got up and came back to the table to listen to Lebedev's outpourings, as the latter passionately commentated on Evgeny Pavlovich's paradox. "That is an artful and treacherous idea, a smart notion," vociferated the clerk, "thrown out as an apple of discord. But it is just. You are a scoffer, a man of the world, a cavalry officer, and, though not without brains, you do not realize how profound is your thought, nor how true. Yes, the laws of self-preservation and of self-destruction are equally powerful in this world. The devil will hold his empire over humanity until a limit of time which is still unknown." "You laugh! You do not believe in the devil? Scepticism as to the devil is a French idea, and is also a frivolous idea. Do you know who the devil is? Do you know his name? Although you don't know his name, you make a mockery of his form, following the example of Voltaire. You sneer at his hoofs, his tail, at his horns, all of them the produce of your imagination. In reality, the devil is a great and terrible spirit, with neither hoofs, nor tail, nor horns. It is you who have endowed him with these attributes. But it is not the question just now." "How do you know he is not the question now?" cried Hippolyte, laughing hysterically. "Another excellent idea and worth considering," replied Lebedev. "But again, that is not the question. The question at the moment is whether we have not weakened the spring of life by the extension of railways," put in Kolia eagerly. "Not railways, properly speaking, presumptuous youth, but the general tendency of which railways may be considered as the outward expression and symbol. We hurry and push and hustle for the good of humanity. The world is becoming too noisy, too commercial," groans some solitary thinker. "Undoubtedly it is, but the noise of wagons bearing bread to starving humanity is of more value than tranquillity of soul," replies another triumphantly, and passes on with an air of pride. "As for me, I don't believe in these wagons bringing bread to humanity, for, founded on no moral principle, these may well, even in the act of carrying bread to humanity, coldly exclude a considerable portion of humanity from enjoying it. That has been seen more than once." "What these wagons may coldly exclude?" repeated someone. "That has been seen already," continued Lebedev, not deigning to notice the interruption. "Malthus was a friend of humanity, but with ill-founded moral principles. The friend of humanity is the devourer of humanity, without mentioning his pride. For touch the vanity of one of these numberless philanthropists, and to avenge his self-esteem, he will be ready at once to set fire to the whole globe. And to tell the truth, we are more or less like that. I, perhaps, might be the first to set a light to the fuel and then run away. But again, I must repeat, that is not the question." "What is it then, for goodness sake?" "He is boring us." "The question is connected with the following anecdote of past times, for I am obliged to relate to a story. In our times, in our country, which I hope you love as much as I do, for as far as I am concerned, I am ready to shed the last drop of my blood—" "Gone! Gone!" "In our dear country, as indeed in the whole of Europe, a famine visits humanity about four times a century, as far as I can remember, once in every 25 years. I won't swear to this being the exact figure, but anyhow, they have become comparatively rare."
"Comparatively to what?"
"To the 12th century, and those immediately preceding and following it. We are told by historians that widespread famines occurred in those days every 2 or 3 years, and such was the condition of things that men actually had recourse to cannibalism. In secret, of course. One of these cannibals, who had reached a good age, declared of his own free will that during the course of his long and miserable life he had personally killed and eaten, in the most profound secrecy, 60 monks, not to mention several children. The number of the latter, he thought, was about 6, an insignificant total when compared with the enormous mass of ecclesiastics consumed by him. As to adults, laymen, that is to say, he had never touched them. The president joined in the general outcry.
"That's impossible," said he in an aggrieved tone. "I'm often discussing subjects of this nature with him, gentlemen, but for the most part he talks nonsense enough to make one deaf. This story has no pretense of being true. General, remember the siege of Kars. And you, gentlemen,
I assure you my anecdote is the naked truth. I may remark that reality, although it is governed by invariable law, has at times a resemblance of falsehood. In fact, truer a thing is, the less true it sounds.
But could anyone possibly eat 60 monks?
Objected the scoffing listeners. It is quite clear that he did not eat them all at once, but in the space of 15 or 20 years. From that point of view, the thing is comprehensible and natural.
Natural?
And natural, repeated Lebedev, with pedantic obstinacy. Besides, a Catholic monk is by nature excessively curious. It would be quite easy, therefore, to entice him into a wood or some secret place, on false pretenses, and there to deal with him as said. I do not dispute in the least that the number of persons consumed appears to denote a spice of greediness.
It is perhaps true, gentlemen,
said the prince quietly. He had been listening in silence up to that moment, without taking part in the conversation, but laughing heartily with the others from time to time. Evidently, he was delighted to see that everybody was amused, that everybody was talking at once, and even that everybody was drinking. It seemed as if he were not intending to speak at all, when suddenly he intervened in such a serious voice that everyone looked at him with interest. It is true that there were frequent famines at that time, gentlemen. I have often heard of them, though I do not know much history, but it seems to me that it must have been so. When I was in Switzerland, I used to look with astonishment at the many ruins of feudal castles perched on the top of steep and rocky heights, half a mile at least above sea level, so that to reach them, one had to climb many miles of stony tracks. A castle, as you know, is a kind of mountain of stones, a dreadful, almost impossible labor. Doubtless the builders were all poor men, vassals, and had to pay heavy taxes, and to keep up the priesthood. How, then, could they provide for themselves, and when had they time to plough and sow their fields? The greater number must literally have died in starvation. I have sometimes asked myself how it was that these communities were not utterly swept off the face of the earth, and how they could possibly survive. Lebedev is not mistaken, in my opinion, when he says that there were cannibals in those days, perhaps in considerable numbers, but I do not understand why he should have dragged in the monks, nor what he means by that. It is undoubtedly because in the 12th century monks were the only people who could eat. They were the fat among many lean, said Gavrila Ardalionovitch. A brilliant idea, and almost true, cried Lebedev, for he never even touched a laity. 60 monks and not a single layman. It is a terrible idea, but it is historic. It is statistic. It is, indeed, one of those facts which enables an intelligent historian to reconstruct the physiognomy of a special epoch, for it brings out this further point with mathematical accuracy, that the clergy were in those days 60 times richer and more flourishing than the rest of humanity, and perhaps 60 times fatter also.
You are exaggerating, Lebedev,
cried his hearers amid laughter. I admit that it is an historic thought, but what is your conclusion? Asked the prince. He spoke so seriously in addressing Lebedev that his tone contrasted quite comically with that of the others. They were very nearly laughing at him too, but he did not notice it. Don't you see that he is a lunatic, prince? Whispered Evgeny Pavlovitch in his ear. Someone told me just now that he is a bit touched on the subject of lawyers, that he has a mania for making speeches and intends to pass examination. I'm expecting a splendid burlesque now.
My conclusion is vast,
replied Lebedev in a voice like thunder. Let us examine first the psychological and legal position of the criminal. We see that in spite of the difficulty of finding other food, the accused, or as we may say, my client, has often during his peculiar life exhibited signs of repentance and of wishing to give up his clerical diet. Incontrovertible facts prove this assertion. He has eaten 5 or 6 children, a relatively insignificant number, no doubt, but remarkable enough from another point of view. It is manifest that, pricked by remorse, for my client is religious in his way and has a conscience, I shall prove that later, and desiring to extenuate his sin as far as possible, he has tried 6 times at least to substitute lay nourishment for clerical. That this was merely an experiment we can hardly doubt, for if it had been only a question of gastronomic variety, 6 would have been too few. Why only 6? Why not 30? But if we regard it as an experiment inspired by the fear of committing new sacrilege, then this number 6 becomes intelligible. 6 attempts to calm his remorse and the pricking of his conscience would amply suffice, for these attempts would scarcely have been happy ones. In my humble opinion, a child is too small, I should say, not sufficient, which would result in 4 or 5 times more lay children than monks being required in a given time. The sin, lessened on the one hand, would therefore be increased on the other, in quantity, not in quality. Please understand, gentlemen, that in reasoning thus, I am making the point of view which might have been taken by a criminal of the Middle Ages. As for myself, a man of the late 19th century, I, of course, should reason differently. I say so plainly, and therefore you need not jeer at me nor mock me, gentlemen. As for you, General, it is still more unbecoming on your part. On the second place, and giving my own personal opinion, a child's flesh is not satisfying diet. It is too insipid, too sweet, and the criminal in making these experiments could have satisfied neither his conscience nor his appetite. I am about to conclude, gentlemen, and my conclusion contains a reply to one of the most important questions of that day and of our own. This criminal ended at last by denouncing himself to the clergy and giving himself up to justice. We cannot but ask, remembering the penal system of that day and the tortures that awaited him, the wheel, the stake, the fire, we cannot but ask, I repeat, what induced him to accuse himself of this crime? Why did he not simply stop short at the number 60 and keep his secret until the last of his breath? Why could not he simply leave the monks alone and go into the desert to repent? Why not become a monk himself? That is where the puzzle comes in. There must have been something stronger than the stake or the fire or even the habits of 20 years. There must have been an idea more powerful than all the calamities and sorrows of this world, famine or torture, leprosy or plague, an idea which entered into the heart, directed and enlarged the springs of life, and made even that hell supportable to humanity. Show me a force, a power like that, in this our century of vices and railways. I might say, perhaps, in our century of steamboats and railways, but I repeat, in our century of vices and railways, because I am drunk but truthful. Show me a single idea which unites men nowadays with half the strength that it had in those centuries, and dare to maintain that the springs of life had not been polluted and weakened beneath this star, beneath this network in which men are entangled. Do not talk to me about your prosperity, your riches, the rarity of famine, the rapidity of the means of transport. There is more of riches, but less of force. The idea uniting heart and soul to heart and soul exists no more. All is loose, soft, limp. We are all of us limp. Enough, gentlemen. I have done. That is not the question. Not the question now, Excellency. I believe to sit down to the banquet you are about to provide to us. Lebedev had roused great indignation in some of his auditors. It should be remarked that the bottles were constantly uncorked during his speech, but this unexpected conclusion calmed even the most turbulent spirits. "That's how a clever barrister makes a good point," said he, when speaking of his peroration later on. The visitors began to laugh and chatter once again. The committee left their seats and stretched their legs on the terrace. Keller alone was still disgusted with Lebedev and his speech. He turned from one to another, saying in a loud voice, "He attacks education, he boasts of the fanaticism of the 12th century, he makes absurd grimaces, and added to that, he is by no means the innocent he makes himself out to be. How did he get the money to buy this house, allow me to ask?" In another corner was the general, holding forth to a group of hearers, among them Titsin, whom he had buttonholed. "I have known," he said, "a real interpreter of the apocalypse, the late Grigory Semyonovich Burnistrov, and he pierced the heart like a fiery flash." He began by putting on his spectacles, and he opened a large black book. With his white beard and his 2 medals on his breast, recalling acts of charity, all added to his impressiveness, he began in a stern voice, and before him generals, hard men of the world, bowed down, and ladies fell to the ground, fainting. "But this one here," he ends by announcing, "a banquet. That is not the real thing." Titsin listened and smiled, then turned as if to get his hat, but if he had intended to leave, he changed his mind. Before the others had risen from the table, Gania had suddenly left off drinking, and pushed away his glass. A dark shadow seemed to come over his face. When they all rose, he went and sat down by Rogojin. It might have been believed that quite friendly relation existed between them. Rogojin, who had also seemed on the point of going away now, sat motionless, his head bent, seeming to have forgotten his intention. He had drunk no wine, and appeared absorbed in reflection. From time to time he raised his eyes and examined everyone present. One might have imagined that he was expecting something very important to himself, and that he had decided to wait for it. The prince had taken two or three glasses of champagne and seemed cheerful. As he rose, he noticed Evgeny Pavlovitch and, remembering the appointment he had made with him, smiled pleasantly. Evgeny made a sign with his head towards Hippolyte, whom he was attentively watching. The invalid was fast asleep, stretched out on the sofa.
"Tell me, prince, why on earth did this boy intrude himself upon you?" he asked, with such annoyance and irritation in his voice that the prince was quite surprised.
"I wouldn't mind laying odds that he is up to some mischief."
"I have observed," said the prince, "that he seems to be an object of very singular interest to you, Evgeny Pavlovitch. Why is that?"
"You may add that I have surely enough to think of on my own account without him, and therefore it is the more surprising that I cannot tear my eyes and thoughts away from his detestable physiognomy.
Oh, come on, he has a handsome face."
"Well, look at him. Look at him now."
The prince glanced again at Evgeny with considerable surprise. End of part 3, chapter 4.
The Idiot, Part 3, Chapter 5, by Fyodor Dostoevsky, translated by Eva M. Martin. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Alia Mekki. Chapter 5. Hippolyte, who had fallen asleep during Lebedev's discourse, now suddenly woke up as though someone had jogged him in the side. He shuddered, raised himself on his arm, gazed around, and grew very pale. A look almost of terror crossed his face as he recollected. "What? Are they all off? Is it all over? Is the sun up?" He trembled and caught at the prince's hand. "What time is it? Tell me quick, for goodness' sake. How long have I slept?" he added, almost in despair, just as though he had overslept something upon which his whole fate depended. "You have slept 7 or perhaps 8 minutes," said Evgeny Pavlovitch. Hippolyte gazed eagerly at the latter and mused for a few moments. "Oh, is that all?" he said at last. "Then he drew a long deep breath of relief. It seemed he realized that all was not over as yet, that the sun had not risen, and that the guests had merely gone to supper. He smiled, and two hectic spots appeared on his cheeks. "So you counted the minutes while I slept, did you, Evgeny Pavlovitch?" he said ironically. "You have not taken your eyes off me all evening. I have noticed that much, you see." "Ah, Rogojin, I've just been dreaming about him, prince," he added, frowning. "Yes, by the by," starting up. "Where's the orator? Where's Lebedev? Has he finished? What did he talk about? Is it true, prince, that you once declared that beauty would save the world? Great heaven, the prince says that beauty saves the world, and I declare that he only has such playful ideas because he's in love. Gentlemen, the prince is in love. I guessed it the moment he came in. Don't blush, prince. You make me sorry for you. What beauty saves the world? Kolya told me that you are a zealous Christian. Is it so? Kolya says you call yourself a Christian." The prince regarded him attentively, but said nothing. "You don't answer me. Perhaps you think I am very fond of you," added Hippolyte, as though the words had been drawn from him. "No, I don't think that. I know you don't love me." "What? After yesterday? Wasn't I honest with you? I knew yesterday that you didn't love me." "Why so? Why so? Because I envy you, eh? You always think that, I know. But do you know why I'm saying all this? Look here, I must have some more champagne. Pour me out some, Keller, will you?" "You're not to drink any more, Hippolyte. I won't let you." The prince moved the glass away. "Well, perhaps you're right," said Hippolyte, musing. "They might say, 'Yet, devil, take them. What does it matter, prince? What can it matter what people will say of us then, eh? I believe I'm half asleep. I've had such a dreadful dream, I've only just remembered it. Prince, I don't wish you such dreams as that, though sure enough, perhaps I don't love you." "Why wish a man evil, though you do not love him, eh? Give me your hand, let me press it sincerely. There, you've given me your hand. You must feel that I do press it sincerely, don't you? I don't think I shall drink any more. What time is it?" "Never mind, I know the time. The time has come at all events." "What? They're laying supper over there, aren't they? And this table is free. Capital, gentlemen. These gentlemen are not listening, prince. I will just read over an article I have here. Supper is more interesting, of course, but..." Here Hippolyte suddenly and almost unexpectedly pulled out of his breast pocket a large sealed paper. This imposing-looking document he placed upon the table before him. The effect of this sudden action upon the company was instantaneous.
Evgeny Pavlovitch almost bounded off his chair in excitement. Rogojin drew nearer to the table with a look on his face as if he knew what was coming. Gania came nearer too, so did Lebedev and the others. The paper seemed to be an object of great interest to the company in general.
"What have you got there?" asked the prince with some anxiety.
"At the first glimpse of the rising sun, prince, I will go to bed. I told you I would. Word of honour, you shall see," cried Hippolyte.
"You think I'm not capable of opening this packet, do you?"
He glared defiantly round at the audience in general. The prince observed that he was trembling all over.
"None of us ever thought such a thing," Mushkin replied for all. "Why did you suppose it of us? And what are you going to read, Hippolyte? What is it?"
"Yes, what is it?" asked the others. The packet sealed with red wax seemed to attract everyone as though it were a magnet.
"I wrote this yesterday myself, just after I saw you, prince, and I told you I would come down here. I wrote all day and all night and finished it this morning early. Afterwards I had a dream."
"Hadn't we better hear it tomorrow?" asked the prince timidly.
"Tomorrow there will be no more time," laughed Hippolyte hysterically. "You needn't be afraid. I shall get through the whole thing in 40 minutes, at most an hour. Look how interested everybody is. Everybody has drawn near. Look at all of them, staring at my sealed packet. If I hadn't sealed it up, it wouldn't have been half so effective. That's mystery, that is. Now then, gentlemen, shall I break the seal or not? Say the word. It's a mystery, I tell you, a secret. Prince, you know who said there would be no more time? It was the great and powerful angel in the Apocalypse."
"Better not read it now," said the prince, putting his hand on the packet.
"No, don't read it," cried Evgeny suddenly. He appeared so strangely disturbed that many of those present could not help wondering.
"Reading? None of your reading now," said somebody. "It's supper time. What sort of an article is it? For a paper? Probably it's very dull," said another. But the prince's timid gesture had impressed even Hippolyte.
"Then I'm not to read it?" he whispered nervously. "Am I not to read it?" he repeated, gazing around at each face in turn.
"What are you afraid of, prince?" he turned and asked the latter suddenly.
"What should I be afraid of?"
"Has anyone a coin about them? Give me 20 kopeck piece, somebody." And Hippolyte leapt from his chair.
"Here you are," said Lebedev, handing him one, as he thought the boy had gone mad.
"Vera Lukyanovna," said Hippolyte, "toss it, will you? Heads I read, tails I don't." Vera Lebedev tossed the coin into the air and let it fall on the table. It was heads.
"Then I read it," said Hippolyte, in the tone of one bowing to the fiat of destiny. He could not have grown paler if a verdict of death had been presented to him. "But after all, what is it? Is it impossible that I should have risked my fate by tossing up?" He went on, shuddering, and looked around him again. His eyes had a curious expression of sincerity. "That is an astonishing psychological fact," he cried, suddenly addressing the prince in a tone of the most intense surprise. "It is something quite inconceivable, prince," he repeated, with growing animation, like a man regaining consciousness. "Take note of it, prince. Remember it. You collect, I am told, facts concerning capital punishment. They told me so. My God, how absurd!" He sat down on the sofa, put his elbows on the table, and laid his head on his hands. "It is shameful, though what does it matter to me if it is shameful? Gentlemen, I am about to break the seal," he continued with determination. I don't insist upon anyone listening if they do not wish to." With trembling hands, he broke the seal and drew out several sheets of paper, smoothed them out before him, and began sorting them.
"What on earth does all this mean? What is he going to read?" muttered several voices. Others said nothing, but one and all sat down and watched him with curiosity. They began to think something strange might really about to happen. Vera stood and trembled behind her father's chair, almost in tears with fright. Kolya was nearly as much alarmed as she was. Lebedev jumped up and put a couple of candles nearer to Hippolyte, so that he might see better. "Gentlemen, you'll soon see what this is," began Hippolyte, and suddenly commenced his reading. "It's headed, 'A Necessary Explanation,' with the motto, 'Après moi, le déluge.' Oh, deuce take it all. Surely I can never have seriously written such a silly motto as that. Look here, gentlemen, I beg to give notice that all this is very likely terrible nonsense. It is only a few ideas of mine. If you think that there is anything mysterious coming, or in a word, better read it on without any more beating about the bush," said Gania.
"Affectation," remarked someone else.
"Too much talk," said Rogojin, breaking the silence for the first time.
Hippolyte glanced at him suddenly, and when their eye met,
Rogojin showed his teeth in a disagreeable smile and said the following strange words: "That's not the way to settle this business, my friend. That's not the way at all." Of course, nobody knew what Rogojin meant by this, but his words made a deep impression upon all. Everyone seemed to see in a flash the same idea. As for Hippolyte, their effect upon him was astounding. He trembled so that the prince was obliged to support him and would certainly have cried out, but that his voice seemed to have entirely left him for the moment. For a minute or two he could not speak at all, but panted and stared at Rogojin. At last he managed to ejaculate, "Then it was you who came? You?
Came where? What do you mean?" asked Rogojin, amazed.
But Hippolyte, panting and choking with excitement, interrupted him violently. "You came to me last week in the night at 2 o'clock, the day I was with you in the morning. Confess it was you."
"Last week, in the night? Have you gone cracked, my good friend?"
Hippolyte paused and considered a moment, then a smile of cunning, almost triumph, crossed his lips. "It was you," he murmured, almost in a whisper, but with absolute conviction. "Yes, it was you who came to my room and sat silently on a chair at my window for a whole hour. More, it was between 1 and 2 at night. You rose and went out at about 3. It was you, you! Why you should have frightened me so, why you should have wished to torment me like that, I cannot tell, but it was you."
There was absolute hatred in his eyes as he said this, but his look of fear and trembling had not left him. "You shall hear all this directly, gentlemen. Listen.
He seized his paper in a desperate hurry. He fidgeted with it and tried to sort it, but for a long while his trembling hands could not collect the sheets together.
"He's either mad or delirious," murmured Rogojin. At last he began.
For the first 5 minutes the reader's voice continued to tremble, and he read disconnectedly and unevenly, but gradually his voice strengthened. Occasionally a violent fit of coughing stopped him, but his animation grew with the progress of the reading, as did also the disagreeable impression which it made upon his audience, until it reached the highest pitch of excitement. Here is the article. My necessary explanation. Après moi le déluge. Yesterday morning the prince came to see me. Among other things, he asked me to come down to his villa. I knew he would come and persuade me to this step, and that he would adduce the argument that it would be easier for me to die among people and green trees, as he expressed it. But today he did not say die, he said live. It is pretty much the same to me, in my position, which, he says. When I asked him why he made such a point of his green trees, he told me to my astonishment that he had heard the last time I was in Pavlovsk. I had said that I had come to have a last look at the trees. When I observed that it was all the same whether one died among trees or in front of a blank brick wall as here, and that it was not worth making any fuss over a fortnight, he agreed at once, but he insisted that the good air at Pavlovsk and the greenness would certainly cause a physical change for the better, and that my excitement and my dreams would be perhaps relieved. I remarked to him with a smile that he spoke like a materialist, and he answered that he had always been one. As he never tells a lie, there must be something in his words. His smile is a pleasant one. I have had a good look at him. I don't know whether I like him or not. I have not time to waste over the question. The hatred which I felt for him for 5 months has become considerably modified, I may say, during the last month. Who knows, perhaps I am going to Pavlovsk on purpose to see him. But why do I leave my chamber? Those who are sentenced to death should not leave their cells. If I had not formed a final resolve, but had decided to wait until the last minute, I should not leave my room or accept his invitation to come and die at Pavlovsk. I must be quick and finish this explanation before tomorrow. I shall have no time to read it over and correct it, for I must read it tomorrow to the prince and 2 or 3 witnesses whom I shall find there. As it will be absolutely true without a touch of falsehood, I am curious to see what impression it will make upon me myself at the moment when I read it out. This is my last and solemn, but why need I call it that? There is no question about the truth of it, for it is not worth while lying for a fortnight. A fortnight of life is not itself worth having, which is a proof that what I write nothing here but pure truth. N.B. Let me remember to consider, am I mad at this moment or not, or rather at these moments? I have been told that consumptives sometimes do go out of their minds for a while in the last stages of the malady. I can prove this tomorrow when I read it out, by the impression it makes upon the audience. I must settle this question once and for all, otherwise I can't go on with anything.
I believe I have just written dreadful nonsense, but there is no time for correcting, as I said before. Besides that, I have made myself a promise not to alter a single word of what I write in this paper, even though I find that I am contradicting myself every 5 lines. I wish to verify the working of the natural logic of my ideas tomorrow during the reading, whether I am capable of detecting logical errors, and whether all that I have meditated over during the last 6 months be true, or nothing but delirium. If 2 months since I had been called upon to leave my room and the view of Mayor's wall opposite, I verily believe I should have been sorry. But now I have no such feeling, and yet I am leaving this room and Mayor's brick wall for ever, so that my conclusion that it is not worth while indulging in grief or any other emotion for a fortnight has proved stronger than my very nature and has taken over the direction of my feelings. But is it so? Is it the case that my nature is conquered entirely? If I were to be put on the rack now, I should certainly cry out. I should not say that it is not worth while to yell and feel pain because I have but a fortnight to live. But is it true that I have but a fortnight of life left to me? I know I told some of my friends that Dr. B had informed me that this was the case, but now I confess that I lied. B has not even seen me. However, a week ago I called a medical student, Kislorodov, who is a nationalist, an atheist, and a nihilist by a conviction. And that is why I had him. I needed a man who would tell me the bare truth without any humbug or ceremony, and so he did, indeed, almost with pleasure, which I thought was going a little too far. Well, he plumped out that I had about a month left in me. It might be a little more, he said, under favorable circumstances, but it might also be considerably less. According to his opinion, I might die quite suddenly. Tomorrow, for instance, there had been such cases. Only a day or two since, a young lady at Kolomna, who suffered from consumption and was about on par with myself in the march of the disease, was going out to market to buy provisions when she suddenly felt faint, lay down on the sofa, gasped once, and died. Kislorodov told me all this with a sort of exaggerated devil-may-care negligence, as though he did me a great favour by talking to me so, because it showed that he considered me the same sort of exalted nihilist being as himself, to whom death was a matter of no consequence whatever either way. At all events, the fact remained, a month of life no more. That he is right in his estimation, I am absolutely persuaded. It puzzles me much to think how on earth the prince guessed yesterday that I have had bad dreams. He said to me, "Your excitement and dreams will find relief at Pavlovsk." Why did he say dreams? Either he is a doctor, or else he is a man of exceptional intelligence and wonderful powers of observation. But that he is an idiot at bottom there can be no doubt whatever. It so happened that just before he arrived, I had a delightful little dream, one of a kind that I have hundreds of just now. I had fallen asleep about an hour before he came in and dreamed that I was in some room, not my own. It was a large room, well furnished, with a cupboard, chest of drawers, sofa, and my bed, a fine wide bed covered with a silken counterpane. But I observed in the room a dreadful-looking creature, a sort of monster. It was a little like a scorpion, but it was not a scorpion, but far more terrible, and especially so, because there are no creatures anything like it in nature, and because it had appeared to me for a purpose and bore some mysterious signification. I looked at the beast well. It was brown in color and had a shell. It was a crawling kind of reptile, about 8 inches long and narrowed down from the head, which was about a couple of fingers in width, to the end of the tail, which came to a fine point. Out of its trunk, about a couple of inches below its head, came 2 legs at an angle of 45 degrees, each about 3 inches long, so that the beast looked like a trident from above. It had 8 hard needle-like whiskers coming out from different parts of its body. It went along like a snake, bending its body about, in spite of the shell it wore, and its motion was very quick and very horrible to look at. I was dreadfully afraid it would sting me. Somebody had told me, I thought, it was venomous. But what tormented me the most of all was the wondering to who had sent it into my room, and what was the mystery which I felt it contained. It hid itself under the cupboard and under the chest of drawers and crawled into the corners. I sat on a chair and kept my legs tucked under me. Then the beast crawled quietly across the room and disappeared somewhere near my chair. I looked about for it in terror, but I still hoped that as my feet were safely tucked away, it would not be able to touch me. Suddenly I heard behind me, and about a level with my head,
a sort of rattling sound. I turned sharp round and saw that the brute had crawled up the wall as high as the level of my face, and that its horrible tail, which was moving incredibly fast from side to side, was actually touching my hair. I jumped up and it disappeared. I did not dare lie down on my bed for fear it should creep under my pillow. My mother came into the room and some friends of hers. They began to hunt for the reptile and were more composed than I was. They did not seem afraid of it, but they did not understand as I did. Suddenly the monster reappeared. It crawled slowly across the room and made for the door, as though with some fixed intention, and with a slow movement that was more horrible than ever. Then my mother opened the door and called my dog, Norma. Norma is a great Newfoundland, and died 5 years ago. She sprang forward and stood still in front of the reptile, as if she had been turned to stone. The beast stopped too, but its tail and claws still moved about. I believe animals are incapable of feeling supernatural fright, if I have been rightly informed, but at this moment there appeared to me to be something more than ordinary about Norma's terror, as though it must be supernatural, and as though she felt, just as I did myself, that this reptile was connected with some mysterious secret, some fatal omen. Norma backed slowly and carefully away from the brute, which followed her, creeping deliberately after her as though it intended to make a sudden dart and sting her. In spite of Norma's terror, she looked furious, though she trembled in all her limbs. At length, she slowly bared her terrible teeth, opened her great red jaws, hesitated, took courage, and seized the beast in her mouth. It seemed to try to dart out of her jaws twice, but Norma caught at it, and half swallowed it as it was escaping. The shell cracked in her teeth, and the tail and legs stuck out of her mouth and shook about in a horrible manner. Suddenly Norma gave a piteous whine. The reptile had bitten her tongue. She opened her mouth wide with pain. But I saw the beast lying across her tongue, and out of its body, which was almost bitten in two, came a hideous white-looking substance oozing out into Norma's mouth. It was the consistency of a crushed black beetle. Just then I awoke, and the prince entered the room. "Gentlemen," said Hippolyte, breaking off here, "I have not done yet, but it seems to me I have written down a great deal here that is unnecessary, this dream." "You have indeed," said Gania. "There is too much about myself, I know, but—" As Hippolyte said this, his face wore a tired, pained look, and he wiped the sweat off his brow.
"Yes, you certainly think a great deal too much about yourself."
"Well, gentlemen, I do not force anyone to listen. If any of you are unwilling to sit it out, please go away, by all means." "He turns people out of the house that isn't his own," muttered Rogojin. "Suppose we all go away," said Ferdishenko suddenly. Hippolyte clutched his manuscript and, gazing at the last speaker with glittering eyes, said, "You don't like me at all." A few laughed at this, but not all.
"Hippolyte," said Prince, "give me the papers and go to bed like a sensible fellow. We'll have a good talk tomorrow, but you really mustn't go on with this reading. It's not good for you."
"How can I? How can I?" cried Hippolyte, looking at him in amazement. "Gentlemen, I was a fool. I won't break off again. Listen, everyone who wants to." He gulped down some water out of a glass standing near, bent over the table in order to hide his face from the audience, and recommenced. "The idea that it is not worth while living for a few weeks took possession of me a month ago, when I was told that I had 4 weeks to live, but only partially so at that time. The idea quite overmastered me 3 days since, that evening at Pavlovsk. The first time that I felt really impressed with this thought was on the terrace at the prince's, at the very moment when I had taken it into my head to make a last trial of life. I wanted to see people and trees. I believe I said so myself. I got excited, maintained Burdovsky's rights, my neighbor. I dreamt that one and all would open their arms and embrace me, that there would be an indescribable exchange of forgiveness between us all. In a word, I behaved like a fool, and then, at that very same instant, I felt my last conviction. I asked myself now how I could have waited 6 months for that conviction. I knew that I had a disease that spares no one, and I really had no illusions. But the more I realized my condition, the more I clung to life. I wanted to live at any price. I confess I might well have resented that blind, deaf fate, which with no apparent reason seemed to have decided to crush me like a fly. But why did I not stop at resentment? Why did I begin to live, knowing that it was not worth while to begin? Why did I attempt to do what I knew to be an impossibility? And yet I could not even read a book to the end. I had given up reading. What is the good of reading? What is the good of learning anything for just 6 months? That thought has made me throw aside a book more than once. Yes, the wall of mares could tell a tale if it liked. There was no spot on its dirty surface that I did not know by heart. Accursed wall!
and yet it is dearer to me than all of the Pavlovsk trees. That is, it would be dearer if it were not all the same to me now.
I remember now with what hungry interest I began to watch the lives of other people, interest that I had never felt before. I used to wait for Kolya's arrival impatiently, for I was so ill myself then that I could not leave the house, so I threw myself into every little detail of news and took so much interest in every report and rumour that I believe I became a regular gossip. I could not understand, among other things, how all these people with so much life in and before them do not become rich, and I don't understand it now. I remember being told of a poor wretch I once knew who had died of hunger. I was almost beside myself with rage. I believe if I could have resuscitated him, I would have done so for the sole purpose of murdering him. Occasionally I was so much better that I could go out, but the streets used to put me in such a rage that I would lock myself up for days then go out, even if I were well enough to do so. I could not bear to see all those preoccupied, anxious-looking creatures continuously surging along the streets past me. Why are they always anxious? What is the meaning of their eternal care and worry? It is their wickedness, their perpetual detestable malice, that's what it is. They are full of malice. Malice! Whose fault is it that they are all miserable, that they don't know how to live, though they have 50 or 60 years of life before them? Why did that fool allow himself to die of hunger with 60 years of unlived life before him, and every one of them shows his rags, his toil-worn hands, and yells in his wrath, "Here we are, working like cattle all our lives and always as hungry as dogs, and there are others who do not work and are fat and rich." The eternal refrain. And side by side with them trots along some wretched fellow who has known better days, doing light porter's work from morn to night for a living, always blubbering and saying that his wife died because he had no money to buy medicine with, and his children dying of cold and hunger, and his eldest daughter gone to the bad, and so on. Oh! I have no pity and no patience for these fools of people. Why can't they be Rothschilds? Whose fault is it that a man has not got millions of money like Rothschild? If he has life, all this must be in his power. Whose fault is it that he does not know how to live his life? Oh, it's all the same to me now, but at the time I would soak my pillow at night with tears of mortification and tear at my blanket in my rage and fury. Oh, how I long at that time to be turned out, me, 18 years old, poor, half-clothed, turned out into the street, quite alone, without lodging, without work, without a crust of bread, without relations, without a single acquaintance, in some large town, hungry, beaten, if you like, but in good health, and then I would show them—what would I show them? Oh, don't think that I have no sense of my own humiliation. I have suffered already in reading so far. Which of you all does not think of me a fool at this moment, a young fool who knows nothing of life, forgetting that to live, as I have lived these last 6 months, is to live longer than grey-haired old men? Well, let them laugh and say it is all nonsense, if they please. They may say it is all fairy-tales, if they like, and I have spent whole nights telling myself fairy-tales. I remember them all. But how can I tell fairy tales now? The time for them is over. They amused me when I found that there was no even time for me to learn the Greek grammar as I wanted to. I shall die before I get to the syntax, I thought at the first page, and threw the book under the table. It is there still, for I forbade anyone to pick it up. If this explanation gets into anybody's hands, and they have patience to read it through, they may consider me a madman, or a schoolboy, or more likely, a man condemned to die, who thought it only natural to conclude that all men, excepting himself, esteem life far too lightly, live it far too carelessly and lazily, and are therefore, one and all, unworthy of it. Well, I affirm that my reader is wrong again, for my conviction have nothing to do with my sentence of death. Ask any one of them, or all of them, what they mean by happiness. Oh, you may be perfectly sure that if Columbus was happy, it was not after he had discovered America, but when he was discovering it. You may be quite sure that he reached the culmination point of his happiness 3 days before he saw the new world with his actual eyes, when his mutinous sailors wanted to tack about and return to Europe. What did the new world matter after all? Columbus had hardly seen it when he died, and in reality he was entirely ignorant of what he had discovered. The important thing is life, life and nothing else. What is any discovery whatever compared with the incessant eternal discovery of life? But what is the use of talking?
I'm afraid all this is so commonplace that my confession will be taken for a schoolboy exercise, the work of some ambitious lad writing in the hope of his work seeing the light. Or perhaps my readers will say that I had perhaps something to say, but did not know how to express it. Let me add to this that in every idea emanating from genius, or even in every serious human idea born in the human brain, there always remains something, some sediment, which cannot be expressed to others, though one wrote volumes and lectured upon it for 25 years. There is always something, a remnant, which will never come out of your brain, but will remain there with you, and you alone, for ever and ever, and you will die, perhaps, without having imparted what may be the very essence of your idea to a single living soul. So that, if I cannot now impart all that has tormented me for the last 6 months, at all events, you will understand that, having reached my last convictions, I must have paid a very dear price for them. That is what I wished, for reasons of my own, to make a point of in this my last explanation. But let me resume. End of chapter 5, part 3. Chapter 6, part 3 of The Idiot by Fyodor Dostoevsky, translated by Eva M. Martin. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Aylia McKee. Chapter 6. I will not deceive you. Reality got me so entrapped in its meshes now and again during the past 6 months that I forgot my sentence, or perhaps I did not wish to think of it, and actually busied myself with affairs. As a word to my circumstances, when 8 months since I became very ill, I threw up all my old connections and dropped all my old companions. As I was always a gloomy, morose sort of individual, my friends easily forgot me. Of course, they would have forgot me all the same without that excuse. My position at home was solitary enough. 5 months ago I separated myself entirely from the family, and no one dared enter my room except at stated times, to clean and tidy it, and so on, and to bring me my meals. My mother dared not disobey me. She kept the children quiet for my sake, and beat them if they dared to make any noise and disturb me. I so often complained of them that I should think they must be very fond indeed of me by this time. I think I must have tormented my faithful Kolya, as I called him, a good deal too. He tormented me of late. I could see that he always bore my tempers, as though he had determined to spare the poor invalid. This annoyed me, naturally. He seemed to have taken it into his head to imitate the prince in Christian meekness. Surikov, who had lived above us, annoyed me too. He was so miserably poor, and I used to prove to him that he had no one to blame but himself for his poverty. I used to be so angry that I think I frightened him eventually, for he stopped coming to see me. He was a most meek and humble fellow, was Surikov. N.B. They say that meekness is a great power. I must ask the prince about this, for the expression is his. But I remember one day in March, when I went up to his lodgings to see whether it was true that one of his children had been starved and frozen to death, I began to hold forth to him about his poverty being his own fault, and in the course of my remarks I accidentally smiled at the corpse of his child. Well, the poor wretch's lips began to tremble, and he caught me by the shoulder and pushed me to the door. "Go out," he said in a whisper. I went out, of course, and I declared I liked it. I liked it at the very moment when I was turned out. But his words filled me with a strange feeling of disdainful pity for him whenever I thought of them, a feeling which I did not in the least desire to entertain. At the very moment of the insult, for I admit that I did insult him, though I did not mean to, this man could not lose his temper. His lips had trembled, but I swear it was not with rage. He had taken me by the arm and said, "Go out," without the least anger. There was dignity, a great deal of dignity, about him, and it was so inconsistent with the look of him that I assure you it was quite comical. But there was no anger. Perhaps he merely began to despise me at that moment. Since that time he had always taken off his hat to me on the stairs whenever I met him, which is a thing he never did before, but he always gets away from me as quickly as he can, as though he felt confused. If he did despise me, he despised me meekly, after his own fashion. I dare say he only took his hat off out of fear, as it were, to the son of his creditor, for he always owed my mother money. I thought of having an explanation with him, but I knew that if I did, he would begin to apologize in a minute or two, so I decided to let him alone. Just about that time, that is, in the middle of March, I suddenly felt very much better. This continued for a couple of weeks. I used to go out at dusk, like the dusk, especially in March, when the night frost begins to harden the day's puddles and the gas is burning.
Well, one night in Shestilavoshnaya, a man passed me with a paper parcel under his arm. I did not take stock of him very carefully, but he seemed to be dressed in some shabby summer dust coat, much too light for the season. When he was opposite the lamppost, some 10 yards away, I observed something fall out of his pocket. I hurried forward to pick it up just in time, for an old wretch in a long kaftan rushed up too. He did not dispute the matter, but glanced at what was in my hand and disappeared. It was a large old-fashioned pocketbook, stuffed full, but I guessed at a glance that it had anything in the world inside it except money. The owner was now some 40 yards ahead of me, and was very soon lost in the crowd. I ran after him and began calling out, but as I knew nothing to say excepting, "Hey!" he did not turn around. Suddenly he turned into the gate of a house to the left, and when I darted in after him, the gateway was so dark that I could see nothing whatever. It was one of those large houses built in small tenements, of which there must have been at least 100. When I entered the yard, I thought I saw a man going along on the far side of it, but it was so dark I could not make out his figure. I crossed to that corner and found a dirty dark staircase. I heard a man mounting up above me, some way higher than I was, and thinking I should catch him before his door would be opened to him, I rushed after him. I heard a door open and shut on the fifth story as I panted along. The stairs were narrow, the steps innumerable, but at least I reached the door, I thought, the right one. Some moments passed before I found the bell and got it to ring. An old peasant woman opened the door. She was busy lighting the samovar in a tiny kitchen. She listened silently to my question, did not understand a word, of course, and opened another door leading into a little bit of a room, low and scarcely furnished at all, but with a large wide bed in it, hung with curtains. On this bed lay one Terentich, as the woman called him. Drunk, it appeared to me. On the table was an end of candle in an iron candlestick, and half a bottle of vodka nearly finished. Terentich muttered something to me and signed towards the next room. The old woman had disappeared, so there was nothing for me to do but to open the door indicated. I did so and entered the next room. This was still smaller than the other, so cramped that I could scarcely turn around. A narrow single bed at one side took up nearly all the room. Besides the bed, there were only 3 common chairs and a wretched old kitchen table standing before a small sofa. One could hardly squeeze through between the table and the bed. On the table, as in the other room, burned a tallow candle end in an iron candlestick, and on the bed there whined a baby of scarcely 3 weeks old. A pale-looking woman was dressing the child, probably the mother. She looked as though she had not yet got over the trouble of childbirth. She seemed so weak and so carelessly dressed. Another child, a little girl of about 3 years old, lay on the sofa, covered with what looked like an old man's dress coat. At the table stood a man in his shirt sleeves. He had thrown off his coat, it lay upon the bed, and he was folding a blue paper parcel in which were a couple of pounds of bread and some little sausages. On the table along with these things were a few old bits of black bread and some tea in a pot. From under the bed there protruded an open portmanteau full of bundles of rags. In a word, the confusion and untidiness of the room were indescribable. It appeared to me at the first glance that both the man and the woman were respectable people, but brought to that pitch of poverty where untidiness seems to get the better of every effort to cope with it, till at last they take a sort of bitter satisfaction in it. When I entered the room, the man, who had entered but a moment before me, was still unpacking his parcels, was saying something to his wife in an excited manner. The news was apparently bad, as usual, for the woman began whimpering. The man's face seemed to me to be refined and even pleasant. He was dark-complexioned and about 28 years of age. He wore black whiskers, and his lip and chin were shaved. He looked morose, but with a sort of pride of expression. A curious scene followed. There are people who find satisfaction in their own touchy feelings, especially when they have just taken the deepest offence. At such moments they feel that they would rather be offended than not. These easily ignited natures, if they are wise, they are always full of remorse afterwards, when they reflect that they have been 10 times as angry as they need to have been. The gentleman before me gazed at me for some seconds in amazement, and his wife in terror, as though there was something alarmingly extraordinary in the fact that anyone could come to see them.
But suddenly he fell upon me almost with fury. I had no time to mutter more than a couple of words, but he had doubtless observed that I was decently dressed, and therefore took deep offence because I had dared to enter his den so unceremoniously and spy out the squalor and untidiness of it. Of course, he was delighted to get hold of someone upon whom to vent his rage against things in general. For a moment I thought he would assault me. He grew so pale that he looked like a woman about to have hysterics. His wife was dreadfully alarmed. "How dare you come in so? Be off!" he shouted, trembling all over with rage and scarcely able to articulate the words. Suddenly, however, he observed his pocketbook in my hand. "I think you dropped this," I remarked, as quietly and as dryly as I could. I thought it best to treat him so. For some while he stood before me in downright and seemed unable to understand. He then suddenly grabbed at his side pocket, opened his mouth in alarm, and beat his forehead with his hand. "My God!" he cried. "Where did you find it? How?" I explained in a few words as I could, and as dryly as possible, how I had seen it and picked it up, how I had run after him and called out to him, and how I had followed him upstairs and groped my way to his door. "Gracious heaven!" he cried. "All our papers are in it. My dear sir, you little know what you have done for us. I should have been lost, lost!" I had taken hold of the door meanwhile, intending to leave the room without reply, but I was panting with my run upstairs, and my exhaustion came to a climax in a violent fit of coughing so bad that I could hardly stand. I saw how the man dashed about the room and found me an empty chair, how he kicked the rags off a chair which was covered up by them, brought it to me, and helped me to sit down. But my cough went on for 3 minutes or so. When I came to myself, he was sitting by me on another chair, which he also had cleared of the rubbish by throwing it all over the floor, and was watching me intently. "I'm afraid you're ill," he remarked, in a tone doctors use when they address a patient. "I myself am a medical man." He did not say doctor, with which words he waved his hands toward the room and its contents, as though in protest at his present condition. "I see that you—" "I am in consumption," I said laconically, rising from my seat. He jumped up too. "Perhaps you are exaggerating. If you were to take proper measures, perhaps—" He was terribly confused and did not seem able to collect his scattered senses. The pocketbook was still in his left hand. "Oh, don't mind me," I said. "Dr. B saw me last week." I lugged him in again. "And my hash is quite settled. Pardon me." I took hold of the door handle again. I was on the point of opening the door and leaving my grateful but confused medical friend to himself and his shame when my damnable cough got hold of me again. My doctor insisted on my sitting down again to get my breath. He now said something to his wife, who, without leaving her place, addressed a few words of gratitude and courtesy to me. She seemed very shy over it, and her sickly face flushed up with confusion. I remained, but with the air of a man who knows he is intruding and is anxious to get away. The doctor's remorse at last seemed to need a vent, I could see. "He began, breaking off abruptly every other moment and starting another sentence. I am very so grateful to you, and I am so much to blame in your eyes, I feel sure. You see," he pointed to the room again, "at this moment I am in such a position—" "Oh," I said, "there's nothing to see. It's quite a clear case. You've lost your post and have come up to make explanations and get another if you can." "How do you know that?" he asked in amazement. "Oh, it was evident in the first glance," I said ironically, but not intentionally so. "There are lots of people who come up from the provinces full of hope and run about town and have to live as best as they can." He began to talk at once excitedly with trembling lips. He began complaining and telling me his story. He interested me, I confess. I sat there nearly an hour. His story was a very ordinary one. He had been a provincial doctor. He had a civil appointment. He had no sooner taken it up than intrigues began. Even his wife was dragged into this. He was proud and flew into passion. There was a change of local government which acted in favour of his opponents. His position was undermined. Complaints were made against him. He lost his post and came up to Petersburg with his last remaining money in order to appeal to higher authorities. Of course, nobody would listen to him for a long time. He would come and tell his story one day and be refused promptly. Another day he would be fed on false promises. Again he would be treated harshly. Then he would be told to sign some documents. Then he would sign the paper and hand it in, and they would refuse to receive it and tell him to file a formal petition. In a word, he had been driven about from office to office for 5 months, and had spent every farthing he had. His wife's last rags had been pawned, and meanwhile a child had been born to them, and today I have a final refusal to my petition, and I have hardly a crumb of bread left. I have nothing left. My wife has had a baby lately, and I... He sprang up from his chair and turned away. His wife was crying in the corner. The child had begun to moan again. I pulled out my notebook and began writing in it. When I had finished and rose from my chair, he was standing before me with an expression of alarmed curiosity. "I have jotted down your name," I told him, "and all the rest of it, the place you've served, the district, the date, and all. I have a friend, Bakhmatov, whose uncle is a councillor of state and has to do with these matters. One Peter Matveyevich Bakhmatov." "Peter Matveyevich Bakhmatov!" he cried, trembling all over with excitement. "Why, nearly everything depends on that very man." It is very curious, this story of the medical man and my visit, and the happy termination to which I contributed by accident. Everything fitted in, as in a novel. I told the poor people not to put much hope in me because I was but a poor schoolboy myself. I'm not really, but I humiliated myself as much as possible in order to make them less hopeful. But that I would go at once to the Vasily Ostrov and see my friend, and that I knew for certain that his uncle adored him and was absolutely devoted to him as the last hope and branch of the family. Perhaps the old man might do something to oblige his nephew. If only they would allow me to explain all to his excellency. If I could be permitted to tell my tale to him, he cried, trembling with feverish agitation and his eyes flashing with excitement. I repeated once more that I could not hold out much hope, that it would probably end in smoke, and if I did not turn up the next morning, they must make up their minds that there was no more to be done in the matter. They showed me out with bows and every kind of respect. They seemed quite beside themselves. I shall never forget the expression of their faces. I took a droshky and drove over to the Vasily Ostrov at once. For some years I had been in enmity with this young Bakhmatov at school. We considered him an aristocrat. At all events, I called him one. He used to dress smartly, and always drove to school in a private trap, sometimes even witty. Though he was not very intellectual, in spite of the fact that he was always the top of the class, I myself was never a top of anything. He had several times during those years come up to me and tried to make friends, but I had always turned sulkily away and refused to have anything to do with him. I had not seen him for a whole year now. He was at the university. When at 9 o'clock or so this evening I arrived and was shown up to him with great ceremony, he received me with astonishment and not too affably, but he soon cheered up and suddenly gazed intently at me and burst out laughing. "Why, what on earth can have possessed you to come and see me, Terentiev?" he cried with his usual pleasant, sometimes audacious but never offensive familiarity, which I liked in reality but for which I also detested him. "Why, what's the matter?" he cried in alarm. "Are you ill?" That confounded cough of mine had come again. I fell into a chair and with difficulty recovered my breath. "It's all right, it's only consumption," I said. "I have come to you with a petition." He sat down in amazement, and I lost no time in telling him the medical man's history, and explained that he, with the influence which he possessed over his uncle, might do some good to the poor fellow. I'll do it, of course," he said. "I shall attack my uncle about it tomorrow morning, and I'm very glad he told me the story. But how was it that you thought of coming to me about it, Terentiev?" "So much depends upon your uncle," I said. "And besides, we have always been enemies, Bakhmatov. And as you are a generous sort of fellow, I thought you would not refuse my request because I was your enemy," I added with irony. "Like Napoleon going to England, eh?" cried he, laughing. "I'll do it, though, of course, and at once, if I can," he added, seeing that I rose seriously from my chair at this point. And sure enough, the matter ended as satisfactorily as possible. A month or so later, my medical friend was appointed to another post. He got his travelling expenses paid, and something to help him to start life with once more. I think Bakhmatov must have persuaded the doctor to accept a loan from himself. I saw Bakhmatov 2 or 3 times about this period, the third time being when he gave a farewell dinner to the doctor and his wife before their departure, a champagne dinner. Bakhmatov saw me home after dinner, and we crossed the Nikolai Bridge. We were both a little drunk. He told me of his joy, the joyful feeling of having done a good action. He said that it was all thanks to myself that he could feel this satisfaction, and held forth about the foolishness of the theory that individual charity is useless. I too was burning to have my say. In Moscow, I said, there was an old state councillor, a civil general, who all his life had been in the habit of visiting the prisons and speaking to criminals. Every party of convicts in its way to Siberia knew beforehand that on the Vorobiev hills the old general paid them a visit. He did all he undertook seriously and devotedly. He would walk down the rows of the unfortunate prisoners, stop before each individual, and ask after his needs. He never sermonized them. He spoke kindly to them. He gave them money. He brought them all sorts of necessaries for the journey, and gave them devotional books, choosing those who could read, under the firm conviction that they would read to those who could not as they went along. He scarcely ever talked about the particular crimes of any of them, but he listened if any volunteered information on that point. All the convicts were equal for him, and he made no distinction. He spoke to all as to brothers, and every one of them looked upon him as a father. When he observed among the exiles some poor woman with a child, he would always come forward and fondle the little one and make it laugh. He continued these acts of mercy up to his very death, and by that time all the criminals all over Russia and Siberia knew him. A man I knew, who had been to Siberia and returned, told me that he himself had been a witness of how the most hardened criminals remembered the old general. Though in point of fact he could never, of course, have distributed more than a few pence to each member of the party, their recollection of him was not sentimental or particularly devoted. Some wretch, for instance, who had been a murderer, cutting the throat of a dozen fellow-creatures, for instance, or stabbing six little children for his own amusement, there have been such men, would perhaps without rhyme or reason suddenly give a sigh and say, "I wonder whether that old general is still alive," although perhaps he had not thought of mentioning him for a dozen years before. How can one say what seed of good may have been dropped into his soul, never to die? I continued in that strain for a while, pointing out to Bachmatov how impossible it is to follow up the effects of any isolated good deed one may do, in all its influences and subtle workings upon the heart and the after-actions of others. "And to think that you are to be cut off from life," remarked Bachmatov in a tone of reproach, as though he would like to find someone to pitch into on my account. We were leaning over the balustrade of the bridge, looking into the Neva at this moment. "Do you know what has suddenly come into my head?" said I suddenly, leaning further and further over the rail. "Surely not to throw yourself into the river," cried Bachmatov in alarm. Perhaps he read my thought in my face. "No, not yet. At present, nothing but the following consideration. You see, I have some 2 or 3 months left in me to live, perhaps 4. Well, supposing that when I have but a month or 2 more, I take a fancy for some good deed that needs both trouble and time, like this business of our doctor friend, for instance. Why, I shall have to give up the idea of it and take to something else, some little good deed, more within my means, eh? Isn't that an amusing idea?" Poor Bachmatov was much impressed, painfully so. He took me all the way home, not attempting to console me, but behaving with the greatest delicacy. On taking leave, he pressed my hand warmly and asked permission to come and see me. I replied that if he came to me as a comforter, so to speak, for he would be in that capacity, whether he spoke to me in a soothing manner or only kept silence as I pointed out to him, he would remind me each time of my approaching death. He shrugged his shoulders, but quite agreed with me, and we parted better friends than I expected. But that evening and the night were sown the first seeds of my last conviction. I seized greedily on my new idea. I thirstily drank in all its different aspects. I did not sleep a wink that night, and the deeper I went into it, the more my being seemed to merge itself in it, and the more alarmed I became. A dreadful terror came over me at last, and did not leave me all next day. Sometimes, thinking over this, I became quite numb with the terror of it. I might well have deduced from this fact that my last conviction was eating into my being too fast and too seriously, and would undoubtedly come to its climax before long, and for the climax I needed greater determination than I yet possessed. However, within 3 weeks my determination was taken, owing to a very strange circumstance. Here on my paper I make a note of all the figures and dates that come into my explanation.
Of course, it is all the same to me, but just now, and perhaps only at this moment, I desire that all those who are to judge my actions should see clearly out of how logical a sequence of deductions has at length preceded my last conviction. I have said above that the determination needed by me for the accomplishment of my final resolve came to hand not through any sequence of causes, but thanks to a certain strange circumstance which had perhaps no connection whatever with the matter at issue. 10 days ago, Rogojin called upon me about certain business of his own, with which I have nothing to do at present. I had never seen Rogojin before, but had often heard about him. I gave him all the information he needed, and he very soon took his departure, so that, since he only came for the purpose of gaining the information, the matter might have been expected to end there. But he interested me too much, and all that day I was under the influence of strange thoughts connected with him, and I determined to return his visit the next day. Rogojin was evidently by no means pleased to see me, and hinted delicately that he saw no reason why our acquaintance should continue. For all that, however, I spent a very interesting hour, and so, I dare say, did he. There was so great a contrast between us that I am sure we must both have felt it. Anyhow, I felt it acutely. Here I was, with my days numbered, and he, a man in the full vigour of life, living in the present without the slightest thought of final convictions, or numbers, or days, or in fact for anything but that which he was mad about, if he will excuse me the expression. And as a feeble author who cannot express his ideas properly, in spite of his lack of amiability, I could not help seeing in Rogojin a man of intellect and sense. And although perhaps there was little in the outside world which was of interest to him, still he was clearly a man with eyes to see. I hinted nothing to him about my final conviction, but it appeared to me that he had guessed it from my words. He remained silent. He is a terribly silent man. I remarked to him as I rose to depart that, in spite of the contrast and the wide difference between us two, les extrémites se touchent, extremes meet, as I explained to him in Russian, so that maybe he was not so far from my final conviction as appeared. His only reply to this was a sour grimace. He rose and looked for my cap and placed it in my hand and led me out of the house, that dreadful gloomy house of his. To all appearances, of course, as though I were leaving of my own accord, and he were simply seeing me to the door out of politeness. His house impressed me much. It is like a burial ground. He seems to like it, which is, however, quite natural. Such a full life as he leads is so overflowing with absorbing interest that he has little need of assistance from his surroundings. The visit to Rogojin exhausted me terribly. Besides, I had felt ill since the morning, and by evening I was so weak that I took to my bed and was in high fever at intervals, and even delirious. Qualia sat with me until 11 o'clock. Yet I remember all he talked about and every word we said, though whenever my eyes closed for a moment I could picture nothing but the image of Surikov just in the act of finding 1,000,000 rubles. He could not make up his mind what to do with the money, and tore his hair over it. He trembled with fear that somebody would rob him, and at last he decided to bury it in the ground. I persuaded him that, instead of putting it all away uselessly underground, he had better melt it down and make a golden coffin out of it for his starved child, and then dig up the little one and put her into the golden coffin. Surikov accepted the suggestion, I thought, with tears of gratitude, and immediately commenced to carry out my design. I thought I spat on the ground and left him in disgust. Qualia told me, when I quite recovered my senses, that I had not been asleep for a moment, but that I had spoken to him about Surikov the whole while. At moments I was in a state of dreadful weakness and misery, so that Qualia was greatly disturbed when he left me. When I rose to lock the door after him, I suddenly recalled to mind a picture I had noticed at Rogojin's in one of his gloomiest rooms over the door. He had pointed it out to me himself as we walked past it, and I believe I must have stood a good 5 minutes in front of it. There was nothing artistic about it, but the picture made me feel strangely uncomfortable. It represented Christ just taken down from the cross. It seems to me that painters as a rule represent the Saviour, both on the cross and taken down from it, with great beauty still upon his face. This marvellous beauty they strive to preserve even in his moments of deepest agony and passion. But there was no such beauty in Rogojin's picture. There was the presentiment of a poor mangled body which had evidently suffered unbearable anguish even before its crucifixion, full of wounds and bruises, marks of the violence of soldiers and people, and of the bitterness of the moment when he had fallen with the cross, all this combined with the anguish of the actual crucifixion. The face was depicted as though still suffering, as though the body, only just dead, was still almost quivering with agony. The picture was one of pure nature, for the face was not beautified by the artist, but was left as it would naturally be, whosoever the sufferer, after such anguish. I know that the earliest Christian faith taught that the Saviour suffered actually and not figuratively, and that nature was allowed her own way, even while his body was on the cross. It is strange to look on this dreadful picture of the mangled corpse of the Saviour, and to put this question to oneself, supposing that the disciples, the future apostles, the women who had followed him and stood by the cross, all of whom believed and worshipped him, supposing that they saw this tortured body, this face so mangled and bleeding and bruised, and they must have seen it so, how could they have gazed upon the dreadful sight and yet have believed that he would rise again? The thought steps in, whether one likes it or not, that death is so terrible and so powerful that even he who conquered it in his miracles during life was unable to triumph over it at the last. He who called to Lazarus, "Lazarus, come forth," and the dead man lived. He was now himself a prey to nature and death. Nature appears to one looking at this picture as some huge, implacable, dumb monster, or still better, a stranger simile, some enormous mechanical engine of modern days which has seized and crushed and swallowed up a great and invaluable being, a being worth nature and all her laws, worth the whole earth, which was perhaps created merely for the sake of the advent of that being. This blind, dumb, implacable, eternal, unreasoning force is well shown in the picture, and the absolute subordination of all men and things to it is so well expressed that the idea unconsciously arises in the mind of anyone who looks at it. All those faithful people who were gazing at the cross and its mutilated occupant must have suffered agony of mind that evening, for they must have felt that all their hopes and almost all their faith had been shattered at a blow. They must have separated in terror and dread that night, though each perhaps carried away with him one great thought which was never eradicated from his mind forever afterwards. If this great teacher of theirs could have seen himself after the crucifixion, how could he have consented to mount the cross and to die as he did? This thought also comes to the mind of the man who gazes at this picture. I thought of all this by the snatches, and probably between my attacks of delirium, for an hour and a half or so before Kolya's departure. Can there be an appearance of that which has no form? And yet it seemed to me at certain moments that I beheld in some strange and impossible form that dark, dumb, irresistibly powerful, eternal force. I thought someone led me by the hand and showed me, by the light of a candle, a huge loathsome insect, which he assured me was that very force, that very almighty, dumb, irresistible power, and laughed at the indignation with which I received this information. In my room they always light the little lamp before my icon for the night. It gives a feeble flicker of light, but it is strong enough to see by dimly, and if you sit just under it, you can even read by it. I think it was about 12, or a little past that night. I had not slept a wink, and was lying with my eyes wide open, when suddenly the door opened, and came in Rogojin. He entered and shut the door behind him. Then he silently gazed at me, and went quickly to the corner of the room where the lamp was burning, and sat down underneath it. I was much surprised, and looked at him expectantly. Rogojin only leaned his elbow on the table and silently stared at me, so past 2 or 3 minutes, and I recollect that this silence hurt and offended me very much. Why did he not speak? That his arrival at this time of night struck me as more or less strange may possibly be the case, but I remember I was by no means amazed at it. On the contrary, though I had not actually told him my thought in the morning, yet I know he understood it. And this thought was of such a character that it would not be anything very remarkable if one were to come for further talk about it at any hour of the night, however late. I thought he must have come for this purpose.
In the morning we had parted not the best of friends. I remember he looked at me with disagreeable sarcasm once or twice, and this same look I observed in his eyes now, which was the cause of the annoyance I felt. I did not for a moment suspect that I was delirious, and that this Rogojin was but the result of fever and excitement. I had not the slightest idea of such a theory at first. Meanwhile he continued to sit and stare jeeringly at me. I angrily turned round in bed and made up my mind that I would not say a word unless he did. So I rested silently on my pillow, determined to remain dumb, if it were to last till morning. I felt resolved that he should speak first. Probably 20 minutes or so passed in this way. Suddenly the idea struck me. What if this is an apparition and not Rogojin himself? Neither during my illness nor at any previous time had I ever seen an apparition. But I had always thought, both when I was a little boy and even now, that if I were to see one I should die on the spot, though I don't believe in ghosts. And yet now, when the idea struck me that this was a ghost and not Rogojin at all, I was not in the least alarmed. Nay, the thought actually irritated me. Strangely enough, the decision of the question as to whether this were a ghost or Rogojin or not, for some reason or other, interested me nearly so much as it ought to have done. I think I began to muse about something altogether different. For instance, I began to wonder why Rogojin, who had been in dressing gown and slippers when I saw him at home, had now put on a dress coat and white waistcoat and tie. I also thought to myself, I remember, if this is a ghost and I am not afraid of it, why don't I approach it and verify my suspicions? Perhaps I am afraid. And no sooner did this last idea enter my head than an icy blast blew over me. I felt a chill down my backbone and my knees shook. At this very moment, as though divining my thoughts, Rogojin raised his head from his arm and began to part his lips as though he were going to laugh, but he continued to stare at me as persistently as before. I felt so furious with him at this moment that I longed to rush at him, but as I had sworn that he should speak first, I continued to lie still, and the more willingly, as I was still by no means satisfied as to whether it was really Rogojin or not. I cannot remember how long this lasted. I cannot recollect either whether consciousness forsook me at intervals or not. But at last Rogojin rose, staring at me as intently as ever, but not smiling any longer, and walking very softly, almost on tiptoes, to the door. He opened it, went out, and shut it behind him. I did not rise from my bed, and I don't know how long I lay with my eyes open, thinking. I don't know what I thought about, nor how I fell asleep or became insensible, but I woke next morning after 9 o'clock, when they knocked at my door. My general orders are that if I don't open the door and call by 9 o'clock, Matryona is to come and bring my tea. When I now opened the door to her, the thought suddenly struck me. How could he have come in since the door was locked? I made inquiries and found that Rogojin himself could not possibly have come in, because all our doors were locked for the night. Well, this strange circumstance, which I have described with so much detail, was the ultimate cause which led me to taking my final determination, so that no logic or logical deductions had anything to do with my resolve. It was simply a matter of disgust. It was impossible for me to go on living when life was full of such detestable, strange, tormenting forms. This ghost had humiliated me, nor could I bear to be subordinate to that dark, horrible force which was embodied in the form of loathsome insect. It was only towards evening, when I had quite made up my mind on this point, that it began to feel easier. End of chapter 6, part 3.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.